Boston High School marching band back in 1968 when I was a freshman, and he became the marching band drum major. And we graduated high school together at age 18, and I went my way, you know, into UCI and, was, you know, became sort of a, you know, long-haired student type. And Bill, unbeknownst to me, I found out later, went to the Sheriff's Academy, and then at the age of 20 was walking a foot patrol in Watts with a gun on his waist, and he was a LAPD, newly minted LAPD officer. And I thought, wow, what an interesting thing to go from the marching band to, you know, the LAPD, all in just, you know, a few short months. And, so I really thought that was cool. And, you know, conversely, there's another character I grew up with in Orange County there. He was younger than me by several years, and I didn't know him personally, but I followed his story in the press, and his name was Joe Razzo, and he was a smart, good-looking, kind of a tough kid from La Habra, not privileged at all, of Mexican descent, and he got a full ride to Harvard, and he did well there for a couple of years. He maintained B's and studied business, and when he would come home for summers and on holidays and stuff, he committed a chain of armed robberies of liquor stores, mostly because he couldn't get his jollies out at Harvard. So he stuck up liquor stores with guns. And then another story was Charles Hatfield, the famous rainmaker from San Diego. Not many people know that story, and I'll tell it to you sometime if you're interested. But he was an interesting guy, and I worked with this myth and this legend of the making of rain, and I've always been intrigued by that idea. It seems to me that anybody who could actually make rain is like one teensy little step down from God himself, you know. So those things, a drum major, a Harvard-educated stick-up artist, and a rainmaker, all kind of coming together in this book. I put them into the pot and stirred.
You sure did. you sure did. And what happens is pretty incredible. You have quite a lot going on here too, with sort of the Mexican mafia.
Yes.
A lot of gang stuff, and I'm curious how much research you had to do for that.
Mexican mafia. Well, you know, they're well documented. They're written about a lot. We all know that they're the preeminent prison gang in America, if not the world. Very powerful, very numerous, ruthless. Ultra-violent at times, entrenched, you know. They began in the, I think it was the 50s, up in Tracy Correctional Prison in California, as an answer to the bullying racist white, you know, gangs that ran the prison system at that time, the inmates. And as the Mexicans got more, more representation at the prison level, they started their own gang to fight back, and La MA fought back beautifully, and they call a lot of shots right now. So, you know, my experience with them is, I've read some books written, you know, about and by them. Web research certainly, and I did spend some time at Pelican Bay Prison to do research for the scenes in Storm Runners, in which Mike, who is based on the Harvard stick-up guy, is incarcerated. He's there and he's calling the shots, but he's in Pelican Bay Prison, and so I spent a day up there talking to some people and seeing the place, and I wanted to capture some of that kind of awesome industrial just hopelessness that a big prison has about it, and hopefully that came through in the pages of the book.
It sure did. Before we go on, though, why don't you read to us so everybody knows what we're talking about?
Okay.
And if you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing, and T. Jefferson Parker is about to read from Storm Runners, just out from Morrow.
Okay, Barbara, I got a short chapter one here, and I'll just read the two pages that is chapter one, and that will get everyone here on the same footing anyway with regard to how the story starts.
Okay.
So, is my voice clear? Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're great.
Okay, here goes. Stromso was in high school when he met the boy who would someday murder his wife and son. The boy's name was Mike Tavarez. Tavarez was shy and curly-haired, and he stared as Stromso lay the mace on the cafeteria table. A mace is a stylized baton brandished by a drum major, which is what Matt Stromso had decided to become. Tavarez held his rented clarinet, which he hoped to play in the same marching band that Stromso hoped to lead. "Sweet," said Tavarez. He had a dimple and fawn eyes. He could play all of the woodwinds, cornet and sax, and pretty much any percussion instrument. He had joined the marching to meet girls. He was impressed by Stromso's bold decision to try out for drum major now in only his freshman year. But this was 1980 in Southern California, where drum majoring had long ago slipped down the list of high school cool. A little crowd of students had stopped to look at the mace. It was not quite 5 feet long, black-handled, with a chrome chain winding down its length. At one end was an eagle ornament, and at the other, a black rubber tip. "How much did it cost?" asked Tavares. $99, said Stromso. "It's the All-American model, the best one they had." "Waste of money," said a football player. "May I help you?" asked Stromso, regarding him with a level gaze. Though he was only a freshman and a drum major hopeful, Stromso was big at 14, and there was something incontrovertible about him. He had expressive blue eyes and a chubby, rosy-cheeked face that looked as if he would soon outgrow it. "Whatever," said the football player. "Then move along," said Stromso. Tavares looked from the athlete to the drum major in making. The football player shuffled, shrugged, walked away, a red and leather Santa Ana Saints varsity jacket over baggy sweatpants, the outsized athletic shoes with the laces gone. Tavares thought the guy might take Stromso in a fight, but he had also seen Stromso's look, what the boys in Delhi F Troop called ojos de piedros, eyes of stone. Delhi F Troop turf included the Tavares family's small stucco home on Flora Street, and though Tavares avoided the gangs, he liked their solidarity and colorful language. Tavares figured that the football player must have seen the look, too. That Saturday, Matt Stromso won the drum major tryouts. He was the only candidate. But his natural sense of rhythm was good, and his summer months of solitary practice paid off. He had been accepted for summer clinics at the venerable Smith-Walbridge Drum Major Camp in Illinois, but had not been able to come up with the money. His parents had thought it all would pass. On Friday, Mike Tavares nailed the third B-flat clarinet spot, easily outplaying the other chairs and doing his best to seem humble. He played his pieces, then spent most of the day quietly loitering around the music rooms, smiling at the female musicians, but failing to catch an eye. He was slender and angelic, but showed no force of personality. Stromso watched those Friday tryouts, noting the cool satisfaction on Tavares's face as he played an animated version of When the Saints Go Marching In. The song was a Santa Ana High School staple. By the time Stromso retired his mace, 4 years later, he had heard the song, blaring behind him as he led the march, well over 500 times. He always liked the reckless joy of it. When his band was playing it aggressively, it sounded like the whole happy melody was about to blow into chaos. Marching across the emerald grass of Santa Ana Stadium on a warm fall night, his shako hat down low over his eyes and his eagle-headed All-American mace flashing in the bright lights, Stromso had sometimes imagined the notes of the song bursting like fireworks into the night behind him. The song was running through his mind 21 years later when the bomb went off.
Thank you so much. That was T. Jefferson Parker reading from Storm Runners, published by Morrow. That was such a compelling first chapter, and I'm going to ask you probably what I've asked you before, and that is, was that always the beginning of the book? Was that chapter, was that first line the beginning of the book?
Yes. I spent a lot of time thinking about that first line, and the first chapter especially. I wanted to set the record straight really, really quickly about what had happened between Mike and Matt. You know, this is not a mystery in the sense that something is solved or a truth is uncovered or a perpetrator is unmasked. This is a story about action and reaction and vengeance and survival. And so that first sentence was important to me. Occasionally, I like to be led down the lengthy path of a novel, questing for answers to things, to mysteries that are created by the author. And sometimes I just flat out want to get on with it. And I wanted to flat out get on with it with this book. And so that first sentence, Stromso was in high school when he met the boy who would someday murder his wife and son, says a lot. And I hope that grabs a reader. If that doesn't grab the reader, then I can't grab them.
Mm-hmm. Well, you said you thought for a while about the beginning, and will you talk a little bit more about that process? I mean, did you play around with different beginnings and you know, mess around for however long a time before you knew this was it, or how does that go for you?
You know, that's a good question, especially on this book, because this book was it's an odd beginning if you sort of strip it down from, you know, take the language away and just see what it says. You know, it's a very brief scene that takes place in high school, and by the end of the chapter, which is only one page later, you're catapulted ahead in time 21 years. So I had to think about that a lot. I wanted to. It's really important to open a novel at the right time, I think. You know, you want to open the novel at the right moment, and so I thought about that a lot. You know, I could have gone back and played that high school scene sort of verbatim, like you would a flashback in a movie, and take my time and build that scene and show the tryouts and the music and all that. But that didn't seem to be germane. I wanted to kind of just set up the players and then hurtle ahead 21 years. And the very next scene of the book, chapter 2, is him waking up in the hospital after the blast, after this bomb that's referred to. So I thought a lot about it, and I wanted to get off on the right foot, which for me is tell the audience an interesting, compelling truth, and then follow the consequences of that truth.
That's interesting. And also, the backstory then, you leak it in so very slowly and so deliberately so that, you know, every so often you give us a little bit more of what happened. And it's like discovering pieces of a puzzle slowly. And so then, you know, because backstory is a really difficult thing for a lot of new writers, especially. Just how much do I tell? How much do I throw in there at the beginning to grab someone's interest?
Yeah. That's hugely true. You know, too much backstory can really nail you. And I think in Storm Runners, you know, the backstory starts kind of early. I play out a lot of the backstory in the first 50 pages because you learn, as Stromzo recovers from the blast, you learn what led up to the blast, literally. You know, you learn about his relationship with Mike and the friendship that they develop in the marching band and their mutual attraction for a sassy, pretty high school girl they both very much fall for, and the competition for her that ensues and what she does, and then what happens when they get out of high school and move into adulthood, and Mike begins to take his criminal path and Matt begins to take his path into, you know, to law enforcement. I use that first 50 pages to kind of cover all that, and some people, you know, some readers may get impatient with that, and my answer to that is I tried to make that backstory as compelling and as brief as possible, but still cover the things that make the present story, that make the big story, the now story, the A line, that make it interesting. You know, because you've got to have both.
Well, that's one thing I really liked about the book is that you just gave it to us very slowly, so that you really had to just, you know, you wanted to keep reading, and you wanted to read fast to get through to figure out, you know, what all happened.
Yeah, what's going to happen?
What all's going to happen? I was thinking, I think when there's a scene in the book where one of the gang members impersonates a cop or a security guard with an old cop car.
Yeah. Oh yeah, he's impersonating a sheriff's deputy.
Sheriff's deputy, that's it. And as I was reading that, I was thinking, I wonder if, or actually wondering if you ever worry about giving too much information or inspiration to the criminals. I mean, are they reading your books? And if they are they getting ideas?
Yeah, you know, I haven't worried about that in a while. I rarely get into really kind of a, you know, highly technical how-to kind of stuff, you know, not really my area of interest or strength. But I will say, with regards to criminals impersonating policemen to the point of, you know, manufacturing or buying, coming up with their own, you know, uniforms and similar firearms and then cars, that to me is a really chilling idea. And that doesn't happen a whole lot in this country, but it happens every day in Mexico. I mean, it's just part of the criminal thing. I mean, we pick up the Union Tribune or whatever paper you read there. I guess in Orange County, you know, L.A. Times, whatever. But I mean, when you read about the, you know, these murders in Tijuana, these cartel competition murders and stuff, they invariably involve crooks dressed up like cops and crooks and cops who actually are crooks. So that is that right out of the newspapers, to tell you the truth. I hope it doesn't catch on in this country. It's a very spooky thing.
Yeah, it was really spooky. And then it was interesting how Stromso, you know, picks up clues from him that he's not who he thinks he is.
Oh, yeah, yeah, the baggy pants.
The baggy pants.
Sticks in his mind because he's seen them before on Mexican officers, yeah.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a real short break, and when we come back, we're going to have more T. Jefferson Parker. He's going to read to us again. And so all of you, stay with us. We will be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month built in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Someone's dropped a bomb somewhere, contaminating atmosphere and blackening the sky.
For thought-provoking dialogue and talks that penetrate Orange County and beyond, listen to Subversity on KUCI 88.9 FM and webcast at KUCI.org. That's Subversity with your host, Dan Tseng, each Monday at 9 a.m. on KUCI.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
Darling, you say you want to write a book? Well, then you must listen to Writers on Writing, darling. Authors, literary agents gabbing and babbling about the art and the business of writing. Thursdays, 5 p.m. Darling, you must. Barbara DeMarco Barrett, she hosts. Yeah, listen, darling.
On KCI FM in Irvine.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're also on the web at kuci.org. And we are podcasting these days. If you go to penonfire.com, click on the radio tower on the left side of the screen, you will reach the radio page, the top of which will give you all the paths to follow to get to the podcast. We have 110, 120 shows up at this point. This one should go up in another week or two. So, and I think there's already a show or two up with Jeff, previous books that you can listen to. We do have a pair of tickets actually to give away, and it's at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion on March 13th. I believe that's next Tuesday night. Madeline Albright, 2 tickets. If you email me at penonfire@earthlink.net, the first email that comes in, we'll get the tickets, and I will send you the voucher, and you will be in L.A. next Tuesday night. Okay, before we bring Jeff back on, I want to give you his website address. It's tjeffersonparker.com. He has all kinds of events going on as well, all over the place. You can go to his website, look at his schedule, and find him at one venue or another. He's going to be here at UCI next week, and he's all over the place. Plus, he has a wonderful website, so check it out. Let's bring him back on. It's T. Jefferson Parker, author of Storm Runners. Hi there.
Hey.
Will you tell the story again about getting your first novel published and just the years it took and sort of the process you went through? I recall you saying you wrote various versions of the book under as if you were different writers, not purposefully, but, you know.
Oh, yeah, sure. You know, typical youngish person, just out of college, very much just out of UCI, as a matter of fact, English major, very much in love with the written word and the great writers of our language, which I'd been studying. Who I'd been studying for the last few years, and I was, you know, burning to write my own material. So I sat down and wrote a book and shelved it and wrote another one, and sure enough, I ended up writing that book like the guys that I was admiring in college. You know, I wrote the first draft of the book that became Laguna Heat. And it really kind of sounded like bad Hemingway. It really was bad Hemingway. And I spent a year on it, and I finished the draft. I finished the novel, but it was bad Hemingway, so I chucked it. And then I spent another year, and I wrote another draft. And when I read it over, I realized it was bad Raymond Chandler, and so I chucked that. Another year had gone by, and so then I wrote another one. And at the end of the third year, I realized I had a draft of Laguna Heat that was bad Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Right. At the end of the fourth year, I had a draft that was bad Jim Harrison, and at the end of the fifth year, I had a draft that was bad Tom McGuane. And so I just thought, you know, I just got to stop doing this. I got to start writing more like me and less like my heroes. And so I did. I sat down. I made a handshake deal with myself that I'd write one more draft, and it would be in my language, not theirs. And any time I got to something that rang of someone else or had been said before or in a similar way, I would steer clear of it, you know, and that I would have, at the end of that time, at least a novel that was mine. It might not be any good or not, but it would be mine. It wouldn't be kind of caged from other writers too much. And so I proceeded and did that. And at the end of 5 years, 6 years, I had 6 drafts, and that last one was decent, and I sent it out, and it, you know, took a little while, a couple of rejections, but it got picked up pretty quickly and edited nicely by a smart young editor at St. Martin's Press, and went on to be a pretty successful book. It was worth every bit of the 5 years I spent working on it, because it really helped set the stage for my whole career. You know, it's really nice to get out with a hardcover publication and good sales and good reviews for the most part, and HBO made a home box office TV movie out of it back in '87 with Harry Hamlin and Rip Horn and Jason Robards, and it was just a sort of a magical time for me. Very fortunate and very lucky, and so 5 years well spent.
You say very lucky, and all the things that happened were wonderful, but getting back to all the years it took, You know, I mean, that you can say it's lucky and you can say it's work. You know, because it's not like you put out a bad novel and suddenly someone snapped it up. You just, you know, sometimes people don't have the right idea about how long it takes and how committed you really need to be.
Yeah, I think that's true. Most writers, if you talk to them, well, you've talked to many more than I have, but it seems like a lot of the ones that I know who are really pretty good writers, they takes them a while, you know. They don't just kind of burst onto the scene suddenly and take it from there, you know. It takes a bit of doing. And I will say that during those 5 or 6 years when I was literally teaching myself to write, I was working as a newspaper reporter for most of those years, and as you said in the intro, and I was working then after that for a couple years as a technical editor on an aerospace project in Irvine, and those were good years. You know, those were years of discovering the world. I was in my 20s. I was kind of, as a newspaper reporter, I was just getting the bare bones of kind of what makes the world work and how, you know, what makes a city work. You know, I covered cops, I covered fire, I covered school board, I covered the arts, I covered, you know, I wrote features. I did everything on that little newspaper, because that's what little newspapers make you do, you know. And so those are good years, you know. And whenever anyone asks me about, you know, the long years of building up the skills to write a novel, I always try to, you know, remind them that those years can be really, really fruitful and really, really kind of fun and really enjoyable. And a lot of young writers, it seems like they want to kind of leap into stardom really quickly and all that good stuff. But God, enjoy the ride.
Mm-hmm. What about the carryover from journalism, from reporting into fiction? What do you carry over?
You know, I think the most important thing that I learned from the 5 years that I worked as a newspaper reporter was my worldview, my seeing firsthand how the world works. It's a really interesting place, and as I said, I did so many different things on that newspaper and was exposed to so many different things, and I'd been kind of a cloistered, you know, suburban kid, and I read my Joyce and my Aristotle at UCI, and I you know, listened to the professors and the literary criticism theorists and what have you, and I thought that was all wonderful stuff. But when you come out of college after having done that, you don't necessarily know, you know, how to put your shoes on, and working for the newspaper really showed me how the world operates on the basic everyday kind of level, and those lessons are wonderful. You know, as a newspaper reporter, as far as writing goes, you learn to be complete and brief, and then the who and the where and the what and all that stuff, and those are wonderful lessons for a novelist. But I think beyond the mechanics of being able to report a news story, you get a wonderful seat for the world.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm here today with T. Jefferson Parker, author of Storm Runners. You talked a bit about Laguna Heat just a few minutes ago and sort of its progression, and you also talked about the beginning of Storm Runners earlier, you know, the first line, the first mm-hmm. chapter. I was thinking today about some of the first lines of your book or first paragraphs, and because they're so difficult to come up with, I think, just that beginning, the perfect beginning. And so I went back to Laguna Heat, that has such a wonderful first line, a perfect morning in a city of perfect mornings, an artist would have worked, a god would have rested. And also Pacific Beat. The main thing here is the Pacific. In the long run, the land and the people on it amount to only that. In the short run, a lot can happen. Talk about first lines and beginnings, and with each book, how are you finding that? Is it a distillation of some sort, or probably not, because that's where you're starting and moving on from.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you after with first lines in general?
Yeah, that's interesting. I've never really been asked directly about that before. I think
well, you do it so well. I just had to talk to you about it this time.
That's cool. That's good. I I'm kind of two minds about opening lines. I think, first of all, if you can give them if you can open a book with a zinger, great, you know, with a really compelling, solid opening line. And I've tried to do that a few times. And those the ones that you just mentioned are the ones that I kind of like the most. I think on the other hand, though, it's perfectly permissible and often probably preferable for a first line to be just good enough to get you to read the next one. You know, I don't think you have to have a an encore quality line to begin every novel. I think sometimes a more modest and quiet sort of invitation into the novel is the way to go. So I'm not really sure. I think it's more kind of what the novel demands. You know, how you want to strike. And as I said earlier, I wanted to write a really compelling sort of can't put it down first line in this book. And I was also setting up the timeline of the storytelling, you know, because I'm going back into high school and then forward in time to when he almost kills his wife and son. As I mentioned before, that's a 21-year leap. So that first sentence actually, in its own way, introduces, you know, sets up the foundation of a 21-year leap, and that is an interesting way to start a book, I think. I'll tell you, to be honest with you, that what got me going thinking about juggling time in that way in the opening line itself is the opening line to 100 Years of Solitude by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And I can't quote the line verbatim, although I used to be able to, but it has something to do with the Captain Buendia standing in front of the firing squad and remembering the day that his grandfather took him to discover ice.
Mm-hmm.
And then the book hooks back and leaves him in front of the squad.
Right.
And it's just elegant and magical and gorgeous beyond belief. And it's one thing that a novel can do that no other art form can approximate. You can condense and you can redistribute time in a novel in such a beautiful way, in such a meaningful way. It's gorgeous when you can do it right or when someone does it right. So that was kind of the inspiration for the Storm Runners line was Marquez, and that one, I'm gonna have to look that up. It's such a great line.
Mm-hmm. It is a great line. I
you know
I can't
I mean,
quote it either, but I remember just being drawn into the book from that line. I remember something on that page about bananas too, but
bananas. Yeah. Sounds right. Yeah.
But I don't know. But anyway, will you read to us again?
Oh yeah, happy to.
And again, it's T. Jefferson Parker reading from Storm Runners.
Yeah. This is a little bit of history that's true that I kind of worked in here. There's a scene where Matt, the cop, the injured, the beat up cop, he's taking the job as a PI, a private investigator, because he's no longer fit for law enforcement. The bomb just basically ruins him. But he can work, and he's sober, and he's, you know, vaguely capable. And so a friend puts him to work in his detective agency. And Strumzo's first job is to protect a San Diego television weather woman from a stalker. She reads the weather. She's a weather woman. She's got a stalker. He follows her to this funny barn out in Bonzel, which is kind of rural San Diego County near where I live here in Fallbrook. And he sees her doing some kind of mysterious things in this barn, and he's not really sure what she's up to. So he goes back the next evening, and he kind of lets himself in. He wants to look around and see what Francis Hatfield is her name, Frankie Hatfield, is up to. So he walks into this barn, and he sees some wooden towers that are made and some big chemical drums and a bunch of books, a bunch of magazines and kind of research-looking stuff and pictures of this handsome guy from the past, black and white pictures of this dude with a fedora and a necktie and stuff. And Strumzo doesn't know what to make of all this stuff, but he's kind of browsing around in this barn. And so we'll pick him up here as he's looking at the bookshelf. Strumzo walked along the shelf and looked at titles. On one shelf, he found a stack of national weather maps. He could hardly make sense of them for all the symbols and designs. On another, two boxes of letters labeled from great-great-grandpa. He opened one. The first envelope he lifted out had a return address for Charles Hatfield of San Diego. He set it back in the nearly full box. A handsome leather magazine holder caught his eye. The first magazine was the Journal of San Diego History from 1970. On the cover was an illustration of the same man pictured on the office walls, slender, wearing a suit and hat, apparently analyzing the contents of a test tube of some kind. The title of the article was, When the Rainmaker Came to San Diego. Stromzo scanned it. Professional rainmaker Charles Hatfield had contracted with the drought-stricken city of San Diego to bring 40 to 50 inches of rain to the city's Marina Reservoir in 1916. He was to be paid $10,000, but only if he was successful. He set up his wooden towers near the reservoir and mixed his secret chemicals that he guaranteed would bring rain. A short time later, it started raining, and it didn't stop. So much rain fell, it overflowed the reservoir, flooded the city, broke a dam, ruined thousands of acres of property. Hatfield was run out of town without ever being paid. The last part of the article was interviews and experts who said that Hatfield's success was simple coincidence, that his secret chemicals were bogus, that Hatfield was a hustler who simply studied the weather patterns for San Diego and tried to defraud the city. I'll be darned, thought Stromzo. Frankie's trying to make rain. He shook his head. Frankie Hatfield's trying to make rain like her great-great-granddaddy did. In an odd and admiring way, he wasn't surprised. Stromzo turned off the office lights, found his way to the leather chair, and sat for a moment. He aimed his flashlight beam on one of the photographs of Charles Hatfield. Stromzo smiled slightly, then clicked off the light and set it on the desk. He locked his fingers behind his head, closed his eyes. The weather lady who makes rain, he thought. He wondered if she had met with any success in her rainmaking venture, if she had told anyone about it, if she was sane. It was possible that the answer to all these questions was no. He sat for a few minutes thinking about how easy it was for catastrophe and heartbreak to kill your hope and your wonder. The death of hope and wonder was the hidden cost charged by every criminal, torturer, and terrorist. Few wrote about that, how the facts of loss are not the truth of loss. Few seem to realize how often and easily the beautiful things vanish, except those from whom they had vanished. And most of all, people didn't have much left to say, did they? Because without hope and wonder, you can't even move your lips. Make it rain, he thought. Amen, sister.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
That was T. Jefferson Parker reading from Storm Runners. One thing I just so love about your writing is that sort of literary sensibility and just the voice. Your voice is, I think, of all writers, your voice is consistently the same to me in all of your books.
Wonderful.
And that's something I always look forward to. And I don't know if that's your intention at all, if you feel that your thumbprint is pretty fixed at this point in terms of voice or how you feel about it. I mean, certain authors you read, you know, voice varies from book to book, and that can be a good thing too.
Mm-hmm.
But I so like your voice, and I wonder if you'd talk about that.
You know, I'm happy that you would say that. I'm a great believer and connoisseur of voices too. You know, I love them. It's the one thing that I really look for in a novel. You know, I mean, I can read a novel for a million different reasons, but if I'm just going to read a novel to enjoy it, for enjoyment, you know, voice is mandatory. You know, you simply have to have it, and so I work at that, you know, and I like to have a voice, and I try to work the sentences over in such a way that they'll have a little bit of rhythm and a little bit of cadence to them. And I guess when you add all those things up, you have voice, and I value it tremendously, and it's good. I'm glad that you get that out of my writing. I think sometimes people read too quickly, and they'll skip over voice, and it's not essentially the voice or the atmosphere or the spell that the writer is casting. It's just kind of more for the it's more to get to the next chapter, or more to solve the mystery, or more to get the information, or whatever it is, and I read slower. I'm a slower reader, and I like voice, and it doesn't, they don't have to sound the same. You know, I like a rapid truncated, uneasy kind of arrhythmic voice. I mean, that can work. It can be really cool. You know, I like long, lush, easy to read sentences. I like and everything in between. You know, but as long as that voice is there and you can hear it, it's really what sort of glues me to the page.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're definitely glued to your pages.
Mm-hmm.
Atmosphere and landscape, too. You just mentioned atmosphere. Landscape always seems to be major in your books. And, you know, it's also very subtle. This time I was reading, as I was reading Storm Runners, I was trying to kind of note where you threw landscape in. And again, I don't know if you even know you're doing it or if you're even trying, but will you talk about that, about atmosphere and landscape and what they mean to you?
Well, you know, I take my cues on landscape and atmosphere from, you know, as a reader, you know. I mean, you know, growing up from the, you know, the time I was tiny to the stuff that I read now, I thrive on that, and I love that. And as a reader, I love to be, you know, physically grounded in where I am and grounded in what time it is and what year it is and what the weather's like and all of that mm-hmm. stuff. You know, mm-hmm. I want to know that. I don't want to be, lectured about it, but I want that stuff to kind of creep in as you need it, you know. So I try to do likewise and give my readers a real firm grounding. I mean, it's a wonderful way to establish verisimilitude and to help to dissolve the disbelief, you know, get them to willingly suspend and enjoy your story, because you're giving them the facts about the town, you know. And all towns have good histories if you pry into them just a little bit, and all neighborhoods have their stories and their secrets. So I kind of like mm-hmm. that. In this book in particular, in Storm Runners, I wanted to write about where I live right now, which is a quirky, interesting little town, agricultural town in North San Diego. It's called Fallbrook. It's kind of tucked behind Pendleton. It's about 15 miles, 12 miles east of Oceanside. Very interesting place. Very much like Orange County was when I moved there, you know, 40 years ago. It's largely, agricultural based. There's still a lot of avocado and citrus and, you know, orange, lemons, and there's commercial nurseries everywhere, and lots of flowers, and it's very fragrant and very slow and very pretty, and it's just a cool place, you know. And I wanted to capture some of that sort of Edenic quality in the place and make it Matt Stromzo's new beginning. You know, it's his new Eden. It's his chance. It's his chance at the age of 30, whatever he is, 36, to start over again. And he finds this beautiful little city just sort of by accident. He takes a place there because it puts him close to the woman that he's going to be protecting from the stalker. And so I hope I brought Fallbrook alive, and I hope that the reader, even if they've never been to Fallbrook, I hope they get loud and clear that this idea that Stromzo has sort of blundered into paradise, and hopefully they'll be rooting for him to be able to put down some roots here.
Mm. Well, yeah, you do nice things with Fallbrook, and again, I was wondering if you worry about making your place so appealing that suddenly you're going to have all these people moving there.
I don't know. They're already moving here, you know, and that's cool. That's good, you know. If people want to move to a beautiful place, you can't knock it. You know, Fallbrook is a neat place. The thing about Fallbrook is you can't commute from Fallbrook, really, unless you're really determined. I mean, you're far from San Diego. The traffic's horrible. You know, you're far enough from Orange County. You're way far from L.A. It's just kind of it's kind of for somebody who doesn't have to drive to work in the morning. And luckily, I don't. I walk to work, and I'm able to live in this pretty little town.
Mm. We have a few minutes left with T. Jefferson Parker, author of Storm Runners. Couple more things. This book has multiple points of view, and curious about that. I think, now, I may be wrong. It just seems that I don't recall many of your other books with such multiple points of view. And regardless, I was curious in terms of this one, why you decided that you were going to write from different characters' point of view.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think that kind of evolves from the idea of the story. Like we said at the top of the hour, this is not really a mystery or a whodunit. It's not about a revelation or an unmasking. It's about as Aristotle would say, it's about men in action, you know. So it's a story of action and reaction and consequence and revenge and what have you. When you're writing a story like that, I think that you can enrich and you can cast a wider net with multiple viewpoints. that's the time to do it, when you have a story like that. A mystery is hard to tell with multiple viewpoints, because then nobody can really tell you what's going on, or it wouldn't be a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
In this book, you know what's going on. You see Leha sitting in the sitting up in the avocado tree, trying to figure out what Frankie's schedule is, so he can follow her and do some damage. You know, you see these people doing these things, and the only real logical way to get to that kind of information and write a scene like that is from his point of view, because nobody else knows he's doing it. You know what I mean? It's kind of an outgrowth of that wide character-driven story, as you can follow the characters and you can watch them do what they're doing, and then move to another one. And in that sort of dance is how the story is told.
Interesting. Oh, and we're at the end of our time again. I feel like I'm always saying that when you're on the show. It does go by quickly. Any last words for the writers who are listening and perhaps struggling through a book?
Well, you gotta enjoy it. You gotta enjoy it. Writing is supposed to be fun and rewarding, and that's not to say that it's always fun or always rewarding. But there should be something in it for you. And you should enjoy your time with yourself and enjoy your time with your keyboard.
Yes. Enjoy it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Barbara.
And great to talk to you again.
Good talking to you.
That was T. Jefferson Parker, author of Storm Runners, speaking to us from somewhere. I think he's on tour. And check out his website at tjeffersonparker.com. Schedule is there. You can catch him at many bookstores, many venues. Great stuff. He's one of my favorites, and I always love a new book coming out by him. What else can I tell you? Free tickets, two tickets. Madeline Albright on March 13th at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion. Pen on Fire at earthlink.net is where you have to email if you want these tickets. In any case, penonfire.com will give you info on the show and who's coming up. And I'm going to leave you now with a quote by John Le Carré, who said, "A desk is a dangerous place from which to watch the world." Thank you so much for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My book is Pen on Fire. I'll see you next time.